Hello, welcome to Sock Talk with JNAB and the Sundance Kid. We are going to explore the frontiers of technology, art, and the human experience. Hello, welcome to episode 5 of Sock Talk. Sorry we were away for a little bit. This is 2 weeks longer than we would have liked to have our next Sock Talk, but we are back. Unfortunately, we don't have our producer Jackie today, so hence we have this wide angle setup because we can't do live camera switching.
As much as we'd like to have replaced Jackie with AI following with current business trends, it's not that at all.
So. No, so you will have to endeavor with this single camera setup. If you're watching the video, that is, a lot of you just listen, so you don't know what we're talking about, and this makes no sense. So getting right in, last week we had our first guest on, Nikki Thompson. During that podcast, we were talking quite a bit about sci-fi, and John and I love talking about sci-fi, so we thought, let's talk about sci-fi. For an overarching theme for today, we're thinking we'll go through some of our favorite sci-fis and talk about some of the technologies and concepts that they introduce, because ultimately they're just fun to talk about and think about. And a lot of these sci-fis have influenced culture and technology, which fits right within the remit of what we like to talk about on this podcast. So it makes a lot of sense. So to kick us off, I had to sit down and a think about what are some of the sci-fis that have stood out to me over my life as I've read and consumed books and TV shows. And to get started, I thought I would go back to 1970, Larry Niven's Ringworld. Have you read it?
Yes, I have.
Yes.
Great book.
It's fantastic. Obviously, the big main concept to talk about in that one is the Ringworld itself. That's a very interesting, big, massive device. I think it ends up having millions of times the surface area of Earth filled with different cultures and species all across the surface of it.
Right. Do you want to just set up for everybody what a Ringworld
yep,
is?
Absolutely. Yep, that's a good idea. So the Ringworld is, imagine a ring in space, expand its circumference out past the length of the orbit of a star. I think in Ringworld, it's at the orbit of Earth, about its circumference. Well, not circumference, it's diameter. And it's on its surface, on the inner surface, facing towards the star, is habitable surface. So trees, mountains, seas, oceans, and they all point inwards towards a star in the center of the system. In Larry Niven's Ringworld, he has other devices to cast shadows on the Ringworld surface so that it has day and night cycles. And that's essentially what the Ringworld is. So that in itself is just fantastic. That has obviously influenced other sci-fis. One that immediately comes to mind is Halo, the video game, which is a smaller version of that. Also going to go into some other sci-fis that use Ringworlds as concepts as well. The idea of exploring this planet, well, not planet, sorry, exploring this device, it's not a device, what would be the word?
I think device is a good one, maybe environment.
Environment, megastructure. Out in space with millions of times the square mile footage of Earth. Just as a human, you know, we've explored our planet. We're done. Well, there is still lots of interesting things to figure out about our planet. And in space, I'm sure there might be lots of interesting planets out there. But then something this big and designed that you could just go out and explore and see all these different species that are there. It's super fun. It's a bit weird as well. It's definitely got kind of a, I don't know if you how much you remember about the book, but all of these species kind of like, where do I put it? What's the scientific word for when species copulate? There we go. Copulate. All of these species end up like having to copulate to like solidify deals and stuff. That's how they're kind of bonobos, all of these species across across the ring world, and it kind of gives off the vibe of this is definitely his fantasy, exploring this millions and millions of square footage and finding all these different species and copulating with them. I didn't want to go down that route so much.
I was going to say, it's not the key point of the novel at all. It's just a little background detail.
That's a little background detail, and I was about to go into that tangent, but that's not the interesting part. But there's other fun tech in that. Well, for one, the Ringworld was actually, I remember seeing that a bunch of physicist students kind of did the calculations and said it wouldn't work. It would be unstructured, like
It wouldn't be able to maintain itself.
it wouldn't be, yeah, and it would collapse. So then he wrote in the next book that it fires off and sustains itself and everything. But it was a fun battle. Another really cool thing I like in that book series is at the start, they're on this ship and they've been charted to go and they've heard about this ring world and they're going to go find it. And they crash the ship on it immediately. The first thing they do is crash on it. But when they crash, the ship doesn't get, it basically crashes into it in light speed and it doesn't get damaged because they have, he creates something he calls stasis fields, which is where a localized field where time is zero within the field. So if you think about F equals MA, if you have acceleration, which is what delta V over delta T.
Very nice.
Yep,
Velocity over
yep.
time. Yeah,
So
change in
if you
velocity over
change T
change in
to
time.
zero, it nulls out the force.
Right.
So,
Because you're multiplying all the other factors by zero. So it
yeah.
doesn't matter if you were going at light speed or something close to light speed.
Yeah. It's the force is zero, which is fun.
It's very, very clever. And other people have used the idea, but I don't think other people have used it as so fundamental to starting a story and then quite irrelevant to all the rest of the story.
That's why a lot of science fiction crosses over a lot to fantasy. And ultimately, that is a fantasy story. It's a massive, massive world that they explore with different cultures and species. And
That's an interesting point. I'd love to get into that with you, maybe later on in the podcast as opposed to now. But I'm very interested in the difference between fantasy and science fiction because I do think they
Absolutely.
walk the knife's edge.
They walk a knife's edge, but they're also a tale of a lot of human experience throughout history as well. Memoirs of a Conquistador. Have you ever?
I have
So
not, no.
it's a first-hand account of conquistador exploring the Southern Americas or Mexico. No, Mexico specifically. Burning of the boats and everything. And just being like, we're conquering this land. And it reads like a sci-fi.
I bet.
To me, because I've grown up with sci-fi more, so those stories to me are, we crash land on an alien planet and there's this weird culture and we're going around. But for them, it's like our boats have crashed and or not they crashed, but we're conquering this world and we're going to meet all these people and they do things differently and it's all weird. It reads like it feels like a
Yeah, I
sci-fi.
bet it
A
would.
lot of
But
these stories are.
to me, the difference between I like the term speculative fiction. A lot of folks say SF instead of sci-fi, and if you're saying SF, then you can replace sci with
Fantasy.
speculative.
Oh, thanks.
And so I like the idea of speculative fiction because a nice distinction I learned a long time ago was that fantasy is just that. Anything might happen. And it works better if you concretize the rules. So you say, these things can happen, those things can't happen. Let everybody have a sense of that before you start telling the story. So nobody is expecting your hero to be able to fly when she falls off a cliff, or nobody is expecting her to fall off a cliff when she can actually fly. The way to concretize the difference that I like is to say science fiction or speculative fiction is speculating on a single point. What if this were true? So if it were true that you had faster than light travel available to everyone, then you could have most of the science fiction adventures that are set in space. If it were true that you had a transporter that could somehow transport you from a ship to the ground and it's still you, not a duplicate, right, then you could have Star Trek. So things like that. You can speculate mostly around one point for good science fiction, but often we buy into the tropes and you have speculation around a lot of known ideas and then a single new one that introduces the story. So Ringworld starts with this idea of faster than light travel and a whole bunch of other stuff in the introduction of the characters. But the notion of the ring world itself is really the speculation. Like it was an idea that you could build space stations like in Arthur C. Clarke's 2001, where they would spin around their own axis and so
Well,
have fake gravity.
I'm going to get into that. This before he did that before then as well.
So all I mean is the idea of a circular structure having an artificial gravity had been around for a long while.
Yep, specifically Hermann Oberth. He was a Nazi scientist. He
One of the rocket scientists, right?
Yes, but he wasn't in Project Paperclip. He was of the bunch, but he wasn't
Wasn't
stolen
one of
by
the
the
ones brought
Americans.
over.
But no, exactly what you like. I love good sci-fis that just ground their whole worlds in What if this? One little thing. A good example of that, which I was literally going to lead into next, was Mass Effect. It's a video game series. 2007 was the first one. And before this video game series came out, I think they, I'm not sure what the relationship they had, but they had a science fiction writer on board to write the lore of the game world before the game. And it, during the game, you can, it has such a well thought out universe, which I love. And the only, well, there's a lot of speculation that they do, but they ground everything in the name of the series, which is Mass Effect. And the one speculation they come up with is that there's an element called Element Zero, and if you put a positive current through it, it increases the mass of objects around it. If you put a negative current through it, it decreases the mass of objects around it.
That's
And
lovely.
from that, it explores out what science could you do if that were true. So they have faster than light travel just by decreasing the mass of the ship. And if you decrease the mass of the ship, then you can accelerate faster and faster and faster past light speed.
That's
To the point, and I think they
fantastic.
even go to negative mass, so you can, really pick up speed and not have time dilation, which is super, super fun. I love that grounding of your speculation. Just one little jump. Okay, if this little jump, what happens?
Yeah, me too. To me, that's a lovely writing challenge and a
Yeah.
lovely thing to play with. And sometimes the ideas that authors use for that little twist are rooted in science of the moment, right? Whatever science is going on right then has inspired a writer to think of this. And it's really fun to look back historically at what was going on that inspired people to
Jules
do that,
Verne.
too. Yeah, for example, submarines exist. What if there was one that never had to surface?
Yep.
Right, like just lovely. Or Mary Shelley. Galvini has been for 30 years or almost 40 years, he's been running electricity through animals. He found out that there's electric current through living tissue and not through dead tissue. And if you run electric current through dead tissue, then the muscles move. So maybe electricity is the force of life. Right? And we still talk about galvanizing. The galvanizing force behind this movement. Right? You are the galvanizing force behind this podcast. Yeah, Galvini. Thank you, sir, for inspiring Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. I just looked up because Jackie's not.
I thought you'd be looking up something.
Well, I wanted to see the science fiction writer you mentioned because that's such a cool thing. I thought it'd be good to get a name
Oh,
to it.
yes,
I
absolutely.
don't know if this is the right name, though. Is it Drew Karpyshyn?
Could be.
It says here, Drew Karpyshyn, sci-fi and fantasy author behind Darth Bane, Revan, Mass Effect, and many other books and
That'll be it.
games.
That'll be him. Yep.
I don't know if I'm pronouncing the name correctly, but it's with a
But
couple
yeah,
of Ys.
I remember getting really, really, 2007, I was getting really excited for that game just because I was reading all the lore and everything before I even played the game.
Nice.
And it was great. It was just a little bit of humanity's journey on that. They'd start exploring the solar system, and then beyond the orbit of Pluto, they just found this giant alien device in orbit. And I think they figure out how to turn it on, and it's like a Stargate kind of thing. Stargate's another, oh, that's another fantastic, fantastic sci-fi. But I'll try to stay on track in the ones I wanted to talk about. So you're talking there about Arthur C. Clarke and
The
the
real
spinning
world.
orbital for artificial gravity. Before 2001, A Space Odyssey is a fantastic story as well. You know the story behind that? Oh, I'm going to tell
I
whatever.
know a few stories behind it. I don't
Yeah,
know which one you mean.
so Kubrick obviously directed it. Kubrick actually wanted to shoot Childhood's End.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so
God, I
Childhood's
would
End
love to
was,
have seen
oh,
that.
that would be amazing. So he came to Arthur C. Clarke and he's like, I want to make Childhood's End. He's like, well, no, let's just make something new. So he wrote 2001, A Space Odyssey with Kubrick alongside the making of the film.
No kidding.
Yeah.
So he wrote the short story
I
or
don't know
he
about the
wrote the
short story,
novel?
or maybe he already had the short story. All I know is that Kubrick wanted to do Childhood's End, and instead they did
Clark said, let's
2001.
do something. Yeah, so maybe that's when he expanded the short story. Maybe that's when he wrote the
It
short
could
story.
be. There's so the, well, yeah, the book. There's a book alongside,
Right.
and there's just slight differences, but it's ultimately mostly the same story. Like I think the monolith is in orbit around Jupiter in the book, but in the film, it's around Saturn just because Saturn's prettier, I think.
I was at a conference last week and said it was Mars during my talk.
No, I'm
No, it
pretty sure
wasn't.
it's
Yeah,
Saturn.
absolutely it was. Yeah, and that was just me being foolish and making mistakes. Speaking of which, Is this an okay time for...
Yeah, actually, we forgot
like
we're going to do that.
Apologize to anyone listening or viewing, and to you and to everyone else in the world not listening or viewing. I tend to make mistakes, as I've mentioned a few times. It's one of those things that was introduced into me when I came to the UK. They said, you'd better start making mistakes, John, or they won't like you here.
Yep.
Not actually true. I was actually making mistakes long before then. So yeah, I've made a bunch of mistakes on the podcast, and there's a couple in particular that I would like to point out.
Go for it.
Of course, now I won't remember. No, when we were talking with Nikki, I very badly told the story of the person everyone calls Edward Muybridge, though often it's pronounced Edward because of the weird spelling of the first name. I used to teach about Muybridge 20 years ago, and somehow I just got some details wrong. So, I left out his name. His name was Muggeridge, Edward Muggeridge, Edward spelt the usual way, and he changed it to Edward or Edward Muybridge, thinking that Edward, with an E-A at the beginning, was the more traditional spelling. So he did that. He was known as a photographer. He was known as, I think, Helios.
Hmm.
I think that I'm probably making another mistake, but I think it was Helios. And a lot of the original black and white photography of some of the great parks in California come from him. And to this day, they're sold as posters with his signature on them, or sometimes without. Anyway, the thing that I got wrong was that I said that he was a madman who killed his wife. He didn't kill his wife.
Right.
He decided that his wife was having an affair, and probably she was. They were decades apart in age, and he spent very little time with her. He went to where the chap she was purportedly having the affair with, where he was working, and shot him dead, and then calmly let himself be arrested.
Mm.
Never protested his innocence, never said anything else. The lawyers who were hired for him argued that he was insane, and said that it was because of a carriage crash he had been in that had caused brain damage, which is probably true. But he refused the defense.
Yeah.
He refused to say he was insane. He killed this man because he had found a photograph of his baby son that the woman had signed, that his wife had signed for this military man. And he assumed that meant that this was actually that guy's son. So he killed him. The jury found him innocent. Not because he didn't do it, and not because he was insane, but because they felt anyone would have done it, which is an interesting point of jurisprudence, and one to watch out for if you're ever visiting California, especially 100 years ago. Time travelers, beware. Strangely, he went on to a long and happy life. His wife died shortly thereafter, and he placed his son in care, wanted nothing to do with him, saying it's not his son. The son grew to old age, died, I think, in California in his 80s or something. He was hit by a car while crossing the street. Everyone says he was the spitting image of his father, but his father denied him for his whole life. So that's Edward Muybridge or Muggeridge or Helios. Sorry, I told the story wrong.
Well, there we go. Now we corrected it for the record.
Thank goodness. The other thing I got wrong, I think in our second podcast, maybe in our first, I was talking about the chap I do more research with than anyone else in the world, Dr. Lucas Esterle of Aarhus University. And I said, he's over there in computing. And when I listened back to it, I couldn't believe I said that. He's not in computing. He's an engineer.
Yeah.
Well. he's in a, I'm going to get it wrong again, and I probably should have it looked up. But he's in the School of Computing Engineering or Engineering and Computing. I'm sorry, Lucas. Man, you have to come and visit and be a guest on the podcast.
Absolutely, please do.
You come and do that, Lucas, and then you can correct it, and we'll have a laugh at how bad I am at this. Really, you'd be very welcome to do that. Yeah, so I'm sorry I've gotten that wrong yet again, but I did want to mention these things that I've gotten wrong. I don't like to let errors go uncorrected. And please, folks, if you're listening or watching or trying to do both and you hear either of us make a mistake, please let us know. We're not going to be pompous about it. We make mistakes.
Yeah, with regular frequency, especially me. I make mistakes with regular frequency. That's why I have some little notes here this time. So I get dates right, like 1970 for Ringworld being released.
I wouldn't have guessed it was 1970. Yeah. I'm glad you said that.
No.
Where were we before that? We were talking
about
Saturn.
Where were we before that?
We were talking about Saturn. Can we go back to Ringworld for a second since you mentioned it? My favorite part of Ringworld was in the sequel.
Yeah.
The first sequel.
Which one's that called again? No, that this is where I did write down.
Yeah, I'm not going to.
There's like Children of Ringworld and other things.
Yeah, there was one that came a while after, and then a bunch of them that came well after that. And I'm sorry, I'm not going to recall or take the time to look them up. But one of the main characters in the first novel is this young woman who doesn't seem to belong on the trip, but there she is. And we find out, spoilers?
If you don't want spoilers for Ringworld, one of the unknown sequels that we're talking about, skip ahead 10 seconds, 20 seconds.
Make it a minute. Skip ahead a minute. Okay, and if you only skipped ahead 10 seconds, that's now. Skip ahead a minute.
Yep.
Okay, so this young woman, we find out towards the end of the first novel that she's the luckiest human that was ever born. And it's an important part of the story. The cool thing is, in the sequel, when he's describing her walk, he says how clumsily she walks because she never fell down as a child, so she never improved her walking. She never got to iterate it, so she walks like a toddler. And I just thought that was such a great detail to add in after the fact.
I love little things like that, just little smart things. There's one of Arthur C. Clarke books as well where he's talking about there's a woman who's traveling to Mars, and it's her first time on Mars, and she's finding the gravity a little bit weird, and the hardest thing for her was keeping her coffee not spilling. Just a simple thing like that, thinking about those everyday human things and what's different. And coffee would react differently in a jar, in a cup, and likely to spill.
Right, that's lovely. That's just lovely.
Yes, so we were there talking before we took a tangent there. Saturn being prettier than Jupiter, and thus they use Saturn. Interestingly, also in Christopher Nolan's Interstellar, that's the name of it, he also used Saturn for a wormhole next to it, just because it's beautiful. I remember in the IMAX, I was in New York actually at the IMAX when I saw Interstellar on the massive screen. And those shots were made for IMAX. You've got Saturn, beautiful, beautiful rings. And when you watch it on a TV, there's a shot of like the ring of Saturn just covering up most of the frame. And there's like a little white dot crossing the frame. And when you watch it on normal TVs, it's just a little white dot. In that IMAX, you could see this station, the ship, like floating across. It was really cool. So, okay, Arthur C. Clarke. Rendezvous with Rama. Have you ever read it?
Many decades ago.
Yeah. So, plot is, we detect something out in the solar system. It's coming past the sun, I believe. It's just kind of doing a fly-through through the solar system. And it's a giant cylindrical device. And they just think it's whatever, it's an interstellar object. But then it starts accelerating away from the sun. So then all of a sudden everyone's paying attention to it because why is it accelerating? Why has it come past is it the periapsis or the apolapsis? There's a periapsis and apolapsis of orbits, and I forget which one's which. But at the point where you would accelerate when you're closest to a gravitational body to get a gravitational sling, it starts accelerating. So it's a ship.
Right.
And then, boom, okay, everyone pays attention and they fly a ship out to catch up with it and see what this is. And it's a giant black cigar cylinder. They figure out a way in, and on the interior of it is a world. Massive cities and everything like this. And the thing I love most about this book, other than just that device in general, it spins for artificial gravity, is that, as we were talking about last episode about professionals, and in Star Trek, everyone is professionals. In this book, everyone is professional. Like, no one gets stupidly killed. At one point, someone kind of takes a risk, but then really is annoyed at themselves for taking that risk. They go in there, they explore it, they do their job well, and document everything well. And there's no moments where you're going, why would you do that? What are you doing? It's just nice and clean. Ultimately, the theme so far of a lot of these is exploration. It's Star Trek, to boldly go where no man has gone before. And that's probably why we love a lot of these stories.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Part of what's cool about fantasy or science fiction is the idea of pushing you beyond what you can experience in your own life.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to prefer science fiction because I don't want it to be too different from life. If your hero finds out that he has magic powers, where does that end? When Luke can draw the lightsaber to him in the ice cave in Hoth, well, then why can't he push the self-destruct button from his ship?
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Like if he can do that, then he should be able to do that. And the answer is, in order to create a story that's more interesting than a guy with psychic powers who sits back in the X mansion and fights all the villains from the padded comfort of Cerebro, the chair, right?
You need rules in your stories.
Yeah, and the rules should serve the story. Mm-hmm. But I like it when they also serve a structure of the universe so that the universe makes sense.
Yeah.
And a lot of folks don't care about that one way or the other.
Yeah, there's a lot of bad sci-fi now, I'd say. Yeah. They've crossed into what I would say is sci-fi fantasy, which is fine. It can be its own thing.
Absolutely.
Star Wars is originally, I would say, more that.
Star Wars, I don't consider science fiction at all. It's a fantasy film.
It's fantasy, which is fine. It can be its own thing, as long as its rules are consistent within its world.
Yep, exactly. I mean, otherwise, lightsabers make no sense as a combat weapon, right? I think I've done that exercise with you as an old fencer. Okay, take your thumb off the button and keep cutting, and now no parry works.
Yep. Or why can't you just turn your lightsaber off on a swing and then turn it back on?
But that's exactly what I mean. So, like, okay, I turn on my sword, you turn on your sword, you do a nice cross overhead parry, covering prime, I guess it is, and I cut down at your head and release the button and press it again.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if my timing is between your sword and your head. I can press it again anywhere past your sword and introduce my blade into your abdomen or anywhere else. Right, like that.
So the lore that you have, I came across a random YouTube video and people explain this and they're like, well, actually,
it takes a moment in
XYZ of books, it was explained that both the Sith and the Jedi is just completely so much forbidden that none of them ever do it.
Really?
So taboo that none of them would ever consider.
Oh, that's hilarious. The explanation I heard, which someone also could quote page and verse for where it comes from, was that it takes a moment for the lightsaber to warm up.
That's a better explanation.
Yeah, and it makes sense with the sound effect too, right?
Yeah.
But the explanation I prefer is, that's not how this works.
Yeah.
Just stop questioning that, question other things, right?
Yeah.
We have to suspend our disbelief.
That reminds me of Ben Affleck, while they were shooting Armageddon. This plot of Armageddon is NASA take a bunch of ragtag oil drillers, train them to be astronauts, and then send them up to an asteroid to split it in half so it will go past Earth. Right. Ben Affleck asked, is it James Cameron? Yeah, James Cameron. Ben Affleck asked James Cameron, wouldn't it be easier for astronauts to be trained how to do the drilling? And he just said, shut up.
Yeah, if we do that, we can't use Tommy Lee Jones or James Garner or any of these classic folk we want to use.
Did I just say James Cameron?
Well, actually, I'm confusing it now with Space Cowboys.
Yeah, Space Cowboys is a different James one.
James Garner and Ben Affleck saying goodbye to, Liv Tyler?
Yes.
Okay, that's
Thingy's daughter.
That's Armageddon.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's Mick Jagger's daughter.
No.
Michael Bay. It wasn't James Cameron. Sorry, Michael Bay.
Yes. Lens flare.
Is Liv Tyler not the Jagger's daughter? Who am I confusing?
No, a different rock star from the same era. And it's embarrassing that I can't think of it. Similar look, I guess you could say.
Steven Tyler. Obviously.
You.
In the name.
Yeah, I kept wanting to say Steven.
At least we're real-time correcting this time, so we don't have to go back on the next episode.
I don't know. It might be better to just go back every now and then and let the flow happen.
Yeah.
Well, you guys let us know. What do you think? Is it better with the interruptions like this?
Yeah, should we correct ourselves on the fly, or should we just keep talking?
Do let us know.
Yes. Okay, so to keep the momentum going.
Please.
One of my other favorite book series is The Culture series by Nina M. Banks. He's a Scottish writer.
Is that the three-body problem?
Nope, that's Jing?
Right. Chinese.
I'm going to pronounce that completely wrong.
What's The Culture series?
The Culture series is by Ian M. Banks. He's a Scottish writer. Died 2000-something.
Okay.
But he was a fantastic, prolific writer.
I remember the name. I recall the name, but I don't recall what he wrote.
He wrote, some of them are Surface Detail, Hydrogen Sonata, Consider Pleiades, whole lot along those. Those are some of the names that are immediately coming to my head.
I don't know if I've read any of them.
You should. I love them.
Cool.
I've briefly talked to you about some of the concepts in them before, just in casual conversations, so I'll go over them on the podcast again because it's fun.
Yes, please.
A lot of his books are different stories in the same universe. He had some sci-fi novels which were outside of this universe, but the majority of them are in the same universe. And this universe follows a post-scarcity, anarchist, utopian, interstellar society. Rolls off the tongue.
It truly does.
Post-scarcity in that they don't have to worry about resources at all. They've figured out physics to the point where energy, matter, doesn't matter too much.
It takes no energy.
Yeah. An anarchist in that every individual can almost pretty much do what they want because there is almost no consequences because a lot of technology reduces all those consequences. For example, death isn't a thing because people have backups. They just make backups and just remake themselves and such. But it follows a culture, and this is this interstellar, super advanced civilization that looks after a lot of species across numerous worlds, and it's all driven by the AIs in that universe that they call minds. And minds are just these hyper, super intelligent entities that are machine-based, ultimately. They can think way faster and way more than any biological being. But they're benevolent. They're completely benevolent. So unlike a lot of other sci-fi series where we have to worry about the AIs coming, these ones are completely benevolent and are essentially gods, really, to the biological beings, and they look after them. Ian M. Banks, we're talking about ring worlds. In this series, they're called orbitals, but they're the same thing. Mm-hmm. In Halo and in this series, Culture series, it makes way more sense to park them. You don't need to build them around a star. You just need to have them in orbit next to a star, and you can rotate them at an angle where the natural rotation, you'll just get a day-night cycle from its own shadow.
Very nice.
Makes way more sense than building giant plates right in orbit.
And you could probably, well, I shouldn't say probably, my physics is probably completely off, but couldn't you also feed their spin so that it's based on the rotation of the planet that they're near or the star that they're near?
No, you don't. You do need to centrifugal force still.
But couldn't you, just like with what's the counter spinning device that keeps things in balance?
Gyroscope.
A gyroscope. Couldn't you have a gyroscopic effect that would cause the thing to spin around its own center?
Yeah, I mean that's what you do. You kickstart it, so it starts spinning.
Right.
But
what I mean is the movement it's got around a star naturally because.
Are you saying for it to have a bit of a wobble? Or,
I don't think it would have to. I think at the right angle.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. So at the right angle, it's in orbit around a star. At the right angle, it's just spinning like this. So it's day-night cycle.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about the day-night cycle. I'm saying you wouldn't have to propel it to spin around itself. If it was set at the right angle and the right distance from the star, the fact that it's turning this way would cause it to also turn this way.
Okay. For those of you listening, we're doing a lot of hand gestures.
Yeah. Sorry, folks. Okay, skip 10 seconds. No.
No.
What I'm trying to suggest is that it's the old experiment about angular momentum, mm-hmm. where if you hold a wheel that's across an axis with two handles and you spin it, maybe it feels like it's pulling your hands a little bit to one side or the other, depending on the direction you're spinning it. If you stand on a plate or a surface that can spin freely and you spin the wheel that you're holding in your hands, turning your hands at different angles will change the direction you spin in. But the spin of the wheel will cause you to rotate.
Yes.
And I think there's something similar that could happen. If the device is naturally orbiting around a star, then it will have a rotation naturally, not just around the star, but around its own balance.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, it'll have its own rotation, spinning.
Right.
But you don't
have to maintain that.
No. You wouldn't have to maintain that naturally. It would happen, no, not naturally. You would have to kickstart it. You would have to have an initial momentum, but once it's spinning, it would never stop because there's no drag.
Yeah, see, I disagree. I don't think you would have to start it, and there is drag. It's just that there's very little drag.
I think you'd have to start it. Otherwise, it would just be orbiting without... Even, remember, with those wheels, they still have to spin them. You still have to kickstart them. If you just held it out like this and started spinning right in the circle, it wouldn't start.
That would
spinning.
Be a different thing. But... If you have to spin that, but once you've put that force into the equation, your body will rotate because of it. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to.
But that would be the star would get an extra bit of rotation, not the device.
I think it's reciprocal.
All right. Maybe.
I don't know.
I'm also not a physicist.
So this is part of the fun of speculation.
We need an astrophysicist to come on board now.
Those of you who are not watching this can't see how much we're both smiling.
But
we both love this kind of thing. This is one of the reasons we became friends very quickly.
Absolutely.
We're happy to speculate and try to be right while being very comfortable that we could be completely wrong.
Absolutely.
And someone more knowledgeable could be sitting here right now and correcting us both, and it would be great.
There's a correction. When we went back, I was just remembering where you're talking about the left, hand, right in this.
I looked
it up. It was, I was right when I was speculating. Is that something to do with chirality? It is. It's chirality. It's specifically what it is. That's the word I remembered, and I'm not going to go any further. I was about to go try and paraphrase as much about chirality as
I can
remember.
But your point
But it means it's something that can't be, it can't be symmetrical. It's a shape or a form that cannot be symmetrical.
Okay, so you can't see the same effect looking from the other direction.
Yeah. If you mirror it, it's a different thing.
Cool.
I think that's what chirality is.
Excellent.
You can tell by my humming and hawing here that I'm not going to stand on that hill and confidently say what that is. But it's
nice.
Chirality is absolutely the term.
Thank you. I'll look it up and become better informed. And I encourage everybody listening or watching to do the same.
Yes.
Well done.
So. Yeah, okay, but orbitals, anyway, the spinning device, actually, funnily enough, whilst I was, this is a long time ago, I don't know where my knowledge is coming from, but while I was reading that, a lot of physicists were like, ring world would not work. Halo, it turns out you can make it out of steel. So in the video game series Halo, it's called Halo because there's a planet and there's one of these orbital rings above it,
right,
or on the side, doesn't matter where it is, but someone calculated you can make that out of steel and it would work.
Wow.
It wouldn't tear itself apart. It would be fine. Now,
really?
That is an absolute dusty piece of knowledge in my head. So I could be completely wrong and I could be completely misinformed with that one. But I do recall it being that. So some more fun concept. Now, why I was talking about orbitals in the culture series specifically is because of these minds. There's a quote at one point where they say that planets are a waste of matter. So that's why they build these orbitals, is because for the amount of matter you get in a planet, you can disassemble that and make millions and millions of orbitals, which also goes into Dyson spheres as well, a little bit.
Right.
The logic behind a Dyson sphere. If you're going to take all the energy from a star, you don't need to build a one solid device, but numerous devices to absorb the energy of the star in orbits around the star. You can essentially get close to 100% of the energy out of the star. Freeman Dyson obviously speculated on that. And he also speculated that you might be able to find advanced civilizations if you see where there should be a star, but there's not a star.
But there isn't anymore.
Yeah. If it was at the mass, so that wouldn't be, but it could still be a black hole then, actually. Could still be a black hole. But I don't know. I'm not going to go too much. I am a filmmaker. I'll resort back to whenever I try and say something too confidently regarding physics, I'll just revert back to I'm a filmmaker, don't.
Nice. Yeah, the line I used the other day in a discussion of neuropsychology was, I'm a farm boy.
Yeah.
And I am. I grew up a farm boy. I am a farm boy.
Well, so was Luke Skywalker.
Fair point. And the Dread Captain Roberts.
Yep.
Or Dread Pirate Roberts, sorry.
Yeah, so they a waste of matter. The unfortunate thing about the culture series is Elon Musk really loves it. Well, that's not an unfortunate thing. It doesn't matter at all. Yeah, well, Elon Musk we could talk about actually as a fun thing. The hype train that exists that aren't looking with their head screwed on.
I have to be careful talking about Elon Musk.
Yeah. But one fun thing that I do like him for is the names of the
children.
No, not the children, but the names of the flotation devices they have that catch the rockets, and they named them after ships in the culture series. So like it's like P.S. I Love You is the name of one of them, but that was the name of one of the ships in the culture series. They all give themselves funny, stupid names, and the P.S. I Love You is one of the ships. And why I was saying he clearly likes the culture series is because he's read it all and he thinks he's doing it. He thinks he's getting us there.
Wow.
Neuralink is literally neural laces in the culture series is mesh devices within brains that are computers that essentially are just capturing the state of a brain at any one time. So that's how they can have backup so easily. It's because they've got laces inside their noggins to take the state of a brain at any one point to be able to recreate it. But the way I love how the Culture series handles this is that the civilization is completely over death and completely over the idea of backups. So in contemporary sci-fi, we have the philosophy of the transporter, where the Star Trek transporter, the way it's described, is it tears apart all your atoms, sends the information. Does it send the information or does it send the literal atoms?
Yeah, good question. It depends on which series of Star Trek you watch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to send the matter. It makes more sense to send the information.
It does. But then the problem is...
Are you you?
Yeah, are you you? In early Star Trek fiction, before there was a second series or a first movie, there were a couple of really great stories written about that, novels about people being sent. I won't go into details about it, in part because I don't want to spoil really great novels, and in part because I'm going to get them wrong anyway and have to come back and apologize. But established characters being transported and then coming back, being transported, killed in a transporter accident, then it ends up they weren't killed.
Yeah.
They were beamed somewhere else and kidnapped. And a corpse was generated at the other end. As a kid reading that, it's like, no, what you've done is you have murdered this character, and you've also made a duplicate. Anyway, it's interesting. In either case, tearing apart the body to its component atoms, essentially dissolving someone, that's a disintegrator ray in science fiction.
You're dead.
Yeah, and not only are you dead, it would take more energy than has ever been consumed on Earth to disintegrate someone to the point of
that's also where we'll exclude that. That's the sci-fi jump. We quite often ignore the energies problem.
Yeah. I mean, the only reason that they came up with the transporter for Star Trek wasn't to have a cool machine.
It's cheaper than having shots of a ship going up and down.
Yeah, cheaper than having to build the ship, cheaper than having to spend time on the ship going back and forth. Right, so at first they tried to convince Roddenberry that the Enterprise should be able to land on a planet, and the alternative was, okay, no, we've got a device. They step in a room, they step out of out into blue sky, or red sky, or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, literal philosophers debate this as well. Yeah. My sense is that let's give that, forget the energy problems. Transporters exist. Let's say they can. Once you step into it, probably that continuity of consciousness is gone. But the one that steps out of it...
Doesn't know that.
Doesn't know that and will have the exact same experience as you, but might not be you.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool science fiction about that. The Prestige was a pretty good Nolan movie, that did that in a nifty way, to a beautifully played version of a Nikola Tesla. By David Bowie, just fantastic. But other science fiction series have done the same thing in interesting ways. I think it's Cory Doctorow, who would be one of my favorite science fiction writers, futurist, blogger, all around really cool guy, freedom of information guy, not in the way that some people use it, but in the real, this helps us all sort of way. Cory Doctorow had a novel in which everyone has a visible HUD, visible heads-up display, that says what their social credit score is.
Oh, yeah.
So you know how much credence to give them. And everyone is working with backups there. But they're not constant. You have to go and back up so that you can be restored.
Save your game.
Yeah, exactly. And it's an interesting idea. It plays on what you were saying. So a character in the novel dies while cave diving and doesn't remember the cave diving because he died doing it, right? The last thing he really remembers is the last backup that he did, but he understands he was cave diving when he died. Right? And what happens with continuity of consciousness? Is this one of those problems where we just have to say, ignore that part? Are we back to that circle brought round again? Or is it something where that would be the interesting thing to discuss in a science fiction novel? I'd read something about that.
It can be. It is in lots of science fiction novels. The one thing I love in the Culture series is that's not the interesting part. They're over it.
So there's multiples of everybody?
So they have rules. They just have, if you accidentally make a copy of someone while the other person still exists, they just live their separate lives.
Nice.
They just, whatever. Oh, I've got a duplicate running around, whatever. Doesn't matter.
They did that in Star Trek The Next Generation, where there was a duplicate of Riker.
And because it's post-scarcity, it's not like there's any resources assigned to one or the other. It's,
right on.
You can, there's enough resources, you'll be fine. So they don't have to worry about that.
It does make me wonder, though, aren't there people who would just say, yeah, there's going to be more of me then?
And so
keep doing that.
They're, in this series, they also have what they call smatter outbreaks, which is where either through von Neumann probes or some other biological or technological thing that keeps self-replicating and growing and growing and growing, they call them smatter outbreaks, and they just eliminate them immediately.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of like against the rules to propagate something over and over and over again. I think I'm right in saying roughly that.
That's cool. It sounds really
cool. I remember the name smatter outbreak specifically because I thought that was a fun term.
Yeah. It makes me want to fill in the what comes before the apostrophe S.
Yeah. And in the series, there's a similar thing with the cave diving. There's a short little story where someone is mining some asteroids, and there, I think it's specifically at that point, a smatter outbreak is coming towards him. Which is disassembling everything and turning it into something else. And he just sits and contemplates, like, oh, no, when was my mask back up? It's like, oh, I'm going to miss this. I'm going to miss that. I'm going to miss this. Oh, well, whatever. That's a shame. And then, boom, it goes away. So there's other fun implications with these mind states that he uses in the series, which is sending mind states as communication. So it's quicker and easier to send information over time, but they can just send a mind state over long distances throughout space. So you can receive a mind state and start conversing with someone's mind state as the, instead of the communication. So it's still real-time communication, but it's a mind state of the person as exactly what they would say and think and feel, and you talk back and forth with them.
And what happens when you're done talking with them? Do they know they're about to die?
Yeah, they know it's a mind. They know that's a mind state of themselves, and they don't care.
You'd think the mind state would care.
You think, but in this series, everyone's over it. They don't care.
Even the ones who are about to die.
But they aren't. Are they? In their concept and philosophy, it's just like, oh, this is a mind state. Okay, I'll just have the conversation I'm here for.
I can get it that you would think that when you receive my mind state.
Yeah.
And I would think that when I sent my mind state.
Yep.
But the mind state, you'd think, would be like, no, this is John.
Exactly. So there's other fun, interesting stories where you could have that sci-fi, of, oh, no, this mind state doesn't want to be turned off. But he never goes there. It's just like there are other things going on. That's not the story here.
Ah, see, it'd be a fun one. If I were still into running games, that would be a fun game to run.
Yeah.
You're a bunch of mind states about to be deleted.
Maybe we are right now.
Ooh.
Well, it's, I forgot the term in philosophy. There's a specific term. There's a term in philosophy specifically where it's a theory that only this present moment exists. For you, everyone listening, yes, you are in the present moment. This is all that exists right now. But there's a theory specifically that is literally it. That's the whole universe, is you right now. There's no past, there's no present. It's just this existence right now. Also, alongside that thought, Boltzmann brains. Boltzmann of the physicist, who is a Boltzmann constant, he proposed that, well, if the universe is infinite, who's to say that somewhere in this infinite universe's atoms, just by chance, have conveniently coalesced together to create a brain, create an experience, and you are that? Which, why not? If you have an infinite universe and an infinite amount of particles, why couldn't that happen? And you're just a random cloud of gases somehow had experience all of a sudden, and everything right now is boom, this is it. Just and then it disintegrates and whatever.
You formed with this fantasy, and now you are dissolving.
And some people take it too seriously and forget there was a reductio ad absurdum. The point of it was to point out that's stupid, and probably not.
Very nice. That's an important thing to say for all those who think they are experiencing such a moment and it doesn't matter what they do.
Yes.
Like day traders and other people who play with the financial well-being of other humans.
Yeah. No, and you can think that you're the center of the universe as much as you can, but turns out things will happen that you have no control over. If you pay attention to that, turns out you don't have control over everything.
Right. And just to be clear, in an infinite universe, infinite...
Yeah.
We are all the center.
True. I'll stay on track with this person has, passed it. That's interesting in sci-fi when people are past. Like right now we can have contemporary discussions about specific elements, but then what happens when you take that as a given and roll with it and see where it goes?
Right. Yeah, I love that. And there's lots of great examples. Mm-hmm. To go back to the Cory Doctorow novel I was mentioning a minute ago, that was called Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. It's his first novel. And if anybody is interested, Doctorow does this really cool thing where at the same time that he publishes books and audiobooks, he doesn't agree with Kindle. He and Amazon hate each other. So all of the e-books that he writes are available for free on a Creative Commons license. So if you go to his website, you can read that novel for free. You can download it for free. He doesn't think novels should be married to technology. He thinks that's a form of theft. Because when you stop using your product, then they take away all your novels that you paid for.
Yep.
Yeah. So I will not say whether or not I think it's theft, because then I'd just be saying I agree with Cory Doctorow. Did I say that? I meant to skip that part. Quiet part out loud. Anyway, well worth reading. This idea of the your social value is really, really played well. And the idea of death being something that people don't think about the same way comes out in the resolution of the novel in a really strong way.
Nice. Yeah. So we're talking about Neural Laces and the Culture series. He plays with that idea quite a bit more, I think, in surface detail of the book. There's a whole B plot about, there's a larger scale plot of the culture is at war with another civilization in the galaxy, essentially. And they're fighting it out virtually. They both agree it's a waste of battery, energy, and resources to do this in reality. So they have their wars in a virtual space. But if I remember correctly, the civilization that they're battling with, it's over an ideology. And the ideology is specifically that this other civilization has an evangelical religion where they've used that technology of being able to take mind states. And with the mind state, you can make a virtual version of yourself, or a real version of yourself.
Right.
But in this other civilization, they do that, but they've basically made a real hell. They've made a real afterlife. So you live out your life normally, and through technology, they make their religion reality. So there is a real heaven and a real hell.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
And you'll pardon my...
It's crazy. That's such a crazy thought. The idea that technology could literally make heaven and hell, an afterlife that you could go to. And that's what this B plot happens as you follow one of these characters of the civilization who's living through the hell.
Right. That's something.
Yeah. Yeah. And the culture is at war with them because they think that's a bad idea. Which I would much rather live in a culture than that other civilization. But again, it's just super fun taking that concept. Like, okay, if you have this technology, what bad could happen? Because we always, we don't always. There are lots of good sci-fis that take powerful technologies and then say, what if it went wrong? Most AI stories are actually that.
Yeah, most science fiction stories are based on that, right?
Actually,
going back to the Mary Shelley novel I referred to earlier. Right,
Frankenstein.
A lot of people say Frankenstein is the first science fiction story. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's true. It's the first one that uses current science and is clearly a horror story developed on the basis of if galvanism is true and you can run electricity into a dead thing and bring it to life. Because a convict that had that done just shortly before, 1817? It was the year without a summer. Right, the year that volcano exploded, and there was no summer that year all around the world.
Krakatoa?
I used to say it was Krakatoa, but it wasn't. It was
the one begin with a J, or one in the region that begins with
a J. I will look it up during a pause and correct it. Anyway, the volcano blew up, so no summer that year all around the world. Hail in London during that spring and summer, July or June or something. So it was really cold, it was really dark. And a bunch of people who are supposed to be having a vacation at Lake Geneva end up cold and miserable and thinking of things to do indoors. And one of them was a storytelling competition. Mm-hmm. Who could write the best story? And so this feminist daughter of a feminist, hanging out with allies, if you don't mind my using the modern term, comes up with the greatest horror story out of the bunch of them.
I think she won.
I think she did. I haven't read the other stories.
I
remember a bit of speculation about how good were the others if you wouldn't share them. But Yeah, it's a fantastic story. It's nothing like the movies.
No.
In the story, this fellow creates life. Frankenstein is the name of the guy who creates life, not the monster. Mm-hmm. I think the monster calls himself Adam.
Yeah, I recall that.
Yeah. And basically, he's beautiful. He's not ugly and monstrous looking. And he decides that his creator has not created him with the right respect and responsibilities. And through a bunch of interesting things, decides that he has to punish Frankenstein by killing the people that he loves.
Hmm.
And so they hunt each other all the way up to the Arctic. Anyway, when she wrote that, galvanism was the latest science. And the idea was, maybe we can bring the dead back to life. And she said in her story, and if we do, maybe it goes wrong.
Yep, yep.
Right,
yep.
And I think that's a vital part of science fiction forever. An earlier version of bringing something to life according to the science of the day would be the medieval story of the golem.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've heard of the golem before.
Vaguely ringing bells.
So in Hebrew, a golem is what humans were before God brought them to life.
Right.
It's just a shaped mass, right? And then God puts his name on them and they become alive. And so this rabbi, faced with anti-Semitic violence in the ghettos, sculpts a golem. A creature out of clay, just like humans were made out of clay, and carves the name of God into its forehead, and mm-hmm. it comes to life and goes out in the ghetto, ghetto being a Jewish-German word, meaning a neighborhood with its own laws, right? And so it goes out into the ghetto and gets vengeance, and gets too much vengeance, and goes mm-hmm. completely overboard. And so it has to be killed in the end by having the name of God rubbed off of its forehead. The name has to be removed, so that it will stop its murderous work. So that might be the earliest science fiction. But
well,
if you go further back to the Iliad.
Iliad,
the Golden Fleece. You know the story of Jason and the Golden Fleece?
Yeah, and the
Fleece?
Argonauts.
Yeah, so when he puts together the Argonauts,
yeah.
right, not the Toronto football team, named after a rowing team when rowing was a bigger competitive sport than football. The Argonauts were the great heroes of the mythological age.
Hmm.
And so there was like a guy with super strength. There was a guy with X-ray vision.
And who's the guy with the lute? Orpheus
and the lyre.
Orpheus was on. Yeah. Was in part of the crew, wasn't he?
Every hero was. Yeah. Yeah. Hercules was, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those superpowers. Some of that was science fiction, right? Yeah. Speculating on. Theseus grew up to be super strong because when he was a little kid, his mom told him, "Carry this calf up this hill."
Yeah, I love that.
Right?
Yeah,
and then do it every day of your life, and by the time you're full grown, it'll be full grown, and you'll be strong enough to carry an ox up the hill.
Yeah.
Right? Based on the science of the time, that was reasonable.
Yeah.
At the same mythological time of those things, at the same time as those mythological things, there was the idea of Hephaestus, the god of the forge, and he was served by robots.
Yes.
He had handmaidens who were made of brass and could think and feel and carry out his biddings. Robots by the modern definition.
Yep.
Not using the word robot.
No, not computing in the way we think about it or anything like that.
Yeah, digital. That's right. Without an onboard computer.
Yeah.
But quite similar in the way they're described to the automatons that were common in the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries, where watch spring style robots existed, where you wind them up and they could perform a series of tasks, writing a letter and things like that. The famous one of a half of a boy sitting at a desk and with a pen and inkwell could write a letter. And it was always the same letter, but it could do that because of the way the mechanisms interacted. The only thing separating any of those from a robot as we think of it now is the idea of computerization and maybe the insertion of intelligence.
Yes, and that also, if we're talking about concepts and the way that people think, a lot of explanations of humanity about how the universe works often reflects whatever the technology is of the time. Like when we were starting to figure out thermodynamics and pressure, the universe was obviously heat and expansion and contraction and all of this. And now that we're into a digital computerized era, we're like, well, it's obviously computing.
It's all a simulation.
We live in a simulation, obviously. It's just contemporary. Our ideologies, the lens that we look at the universe often reflects whatever the technology is of the time.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's a vital point to make. The context in which science fiction is written you know, regardless of the medium and the era, it's the context of that age, of that culture and time. The word robot comes to us from the Czech playwright, whose name I'm not going to recall now. But Russum's Universal Robotics is the English translation. No, I'm not going to get it. Boy, we should do another pause here and look that up.
Yep.
Should we do another pause or just look it up?
I've just got a message from my wife that my dog has defecated on her carpet.
Oh, I think that means pause. We've just cut out a bit there while we both dealt with some things. But RUR was the play written about Russum's Universal Robotics by Karel Čapek, or Čapek. Sorry, let me get that right. Karel Čapek, C-A-P-E-K, but with the little inverted hat over the C. And he just used the Czech word for slave or indentured worker or worker with no choice about the work they do.
Yeah.
Which has become the universal word now for robot. So his idea was artificially created humans were created specifically to do work so that we wouldn't have to. And he wrote that and or produced it as a play. I forget which it was, either wrote it or produced it as a play for the first time in 1920. And then by 1927, we had Metropolis by Fritz Lang, showing a futuristic society in which the extremely wealthy are living in luxury and high towers while everybody else is working like dogs, and a mad scientist is hired to help them keep the workers oppressed, and he creates a robot who also magically transforms into a beautiful woman and vice versa.
Why not?
But yeah, actually, the robot in Metropolis, Fritz Lang's robot, and I forget if she had a name other than just she.
Yeah, I can't.
Yeah. Anyway, call in if you know. She was the visual inspiration for C-3PO.
Yep, that's what I was about to say. If you weren't.
Oh, sorry.
No, absolutely. Yeah, she was.
Yeah, it's lovely how all of this ties together when the people telling stories. Yeah. Love the stories of the past.
As George Lucas says, it rhymes in one of his famous behind the scenes where he's talking about producing prequel series. He starts telling the story about it's like how in the earlier ones that this happens, and it's like it rhymes. So that's his explanation of his own internal creativity, but it actually expands out to creativity in general. Things rhyme with each other.
It's not
an underlying synchronicity that speaks to a more fundamental human experience.
Lovely, like the harmony of the spheres.
Yeah,
that people used to have as their model of the universe.
Yep. Until figured out, it turns out it's a bit more dirtier than we thought. Stam ellipsis.
And in those days, we were in the centermost sphere.
Except for a lot of notable exceptions throughout history of people who actually were closer to accurate science than others.
A lot of that, though, is common sense, right? Like you've seen the demonstration of how the ancient Romans knew that the world was round. So the demonstration I've seen was that if there is a plinth, a rocky spire standing in one place and standing in another place, and you know that the cities are well far apart, then you can record the time of day which positions their shadows are in. And if the earth is flat, their shadows should be in the same position all the time.
I think it was actually before the Romans.
Could well have been.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting demonstration. But anybody who's been on the sea knows that the earth is round, or at least curved, right? And it doesn't make sense that it's curving and the water isn't all running in that direction. If it's not continuous, right? But if you've ever watched anybody go away from shore on a boat, you see them sinking, but they're not sinking.
Yep.
They can come back, right? And that means they're going further down as you go further away.
Now we've just lost all our flat earther listeners.
Thank God.
Yeah.
By which I mean there is no God. Yeah, did we lose some more?
Well, maybe.
Okay, well, if you're offended by my words, good. Good. It's good to be thoughtful and have strong opinions. Please don't be so offended that we can't continue the discussion. You may convince me that I'm wrong. Lots of people have.
Yeah. John may well be wrong.
It has happened. John has been wrong many times today.
Yep. Then that would be a fun podcast. John why he's wrong.
That would be a fun podcast. I would definitely sit in for that. Speaking of things I was wrong about, Mount Tambora was the mount that the volcano that erupted in 1816 and caused the year without a summer. On the topic of favorite science fiction, there's a few things I'd like to mention.
Yeah.
So far, I've been sort of responding to your list, and that's cool. I love it.
Yeah.
But I would like to insert a few that you might not have on your list. To start with, I'd like to talk about David Brin, who's known for his Sundiver series and a bunch of stuff like that, which is excellent science fiction. The short novel of his I like the best in terms of speculative fiction is about a physics grad student who accidentally goes to a new dimension. And it's just because some people are screwing around with his work and screwing around with him. And a competitor for research money and the love of a woman sabotages the work that he's doing. And he finds himself in this alternate reality in which entropy doesn't exist.
Ooh,
so instead of things getting worn down by use, they become better with use.
And so
the novel is called The Practice Effect,
because
you can practice anything into being better. It's absolutely a fantasy novel. It starts with a science fiction premise, but it goes so far with its premises that we have to deal with it as fantasy. It's a fantasy story.
Yeah.
And it's just a fantasy story with a really nice speculative fiction underpinning. So yeah, I'd recommend that strongly to anyone who's not sure if they like fantasy or science fiction or both.
That's great.
It's.
I wanted to respond with that with another one along that theme, but then...
Please, please.
Along that fun kind of theme that's kind of sci-fi but crosses the boundaries into fantasy quite a bit is Off to Be a Wizard. Fun comedy sci-fi fantasy, I guess. And it's been a while since I read it, but I remember the premise. The premise is that there's a kid who's just hacking on computers, and he goes into like a big government databases and just files, and digging around, and he eventually finds himself, the code for himself, and he starts changing things, and it actually changes reality.
That's lovely.
Yeah. So then he figures out he can do a lot of things. He can write scripts and in this code and everything. So he's like, I can be a wizard. Like, I can write scripts and then wave a wand or whatever, and then a script will run and things can work like that. And he's like, wait a minute, I can just change time. What happens if I change time? So he figures out, okay, if I'm going to be able to do this, when in time can I go? I'll go back to when Merlin was about, because then I can be Merlin. And he goes back to that time and finds that, no, there's already Merlin. He's a guy in the 80s who was there before him. And he's got his own scripts and everything like this. And so in this universe, there's people that have eventually figured this out, and they're all calling themselves wizards because they're running scripts on whatever this universal server is. It's super fun.
Brilliant.
I think there's three books in the series.
Off to Be a Wizard.
Off to Be a Wizard,
okay.
Yeah.
I've made note of it, and I will have to look it up. There were a number of great fantasy series based around different similar concepts.
Mm.
Before the age of computing, and I'm trying to recall the author and the name of the series. I think it was called The Complete Enchanter, but I could be wrong, and I think it had two authors. We'll have to fact check this. But the idea was that a mathematician accidentally solved the mathematics of interdimensional travel.
Mm.
And so he could go to mythological lands, specifically to speculative dimensions where this mythology was reality.
Mm.
So he went to the land of Spenser's Fairy Queen. He went to the land of Asgard and had these adventures. I should know this stuff off the top of my head. I think one of the writers was Fletcher Pratt. Maybe it was Fletcher Pratt and Elsbrag de Camp. The character's name was Harold Shea, but I'm not recalling.
It's better memory than I can, because I can't remember any of the main characters' names in any of the books I've mentioned.
Well, I'm going to just see if I've got any of that right. See, this is the danger of doing this live checking, is then we stop talking and start doing this kind of nonsense.
Maybe it's better to confidently be wrong and keep going than stopping and checking. Or if we have a third party.
The third party is the way to do it.
Because we don't have Jackie.
And I am going to stop here, but it is Elsbrag de Camp and Fletcher Pratt who wrote the Harold Shea novels.
Cool.
So, okay, I got that right. I shouldn't have checked it. Lovely, lovely books, playing with the idea that all of the universe is described by some encoded language. And if you understand that even a little bit, you can start playing with the coding.
Yeah.
I do want to read Off to Be a Wizard, though. Sounds wonderful.
Yeah. I think by the end of the third, I can't remember if there's three books. I remember the last one I read specifically which may or may not be the last in the series. I've not checked. There, go to Atlantis, which is a fun one too.
I also just really like the title of that.
Yeah, Off to Be a Wizard.
Off to, as opposed to Off to See the Wizard, yeah, right? Yeah. It's just
it's great.
So clever. Plays with so many things.
Yeah.
I have to mention a couple of other folks when we talk about science fiction. A couple of my favorite writers are from the classic age, and a couple of my favorite writers are much more modern. Robert Heinlein is largely disparaged these days because of a post hoc criticism of his literature. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to defend his literature here. There are some parts of it that are very hard to defend these days, but not for any of the reasons that people talk about. Anyway, if you read the novels he wrote aimed at children in the 40s and 50s, they are fantastic. If you read the novels he wrote for adults in the 40s and 50s and 60s and into the 70s, they're fantastic. And if you come back into the later last years of his life, they're fantastic. There was a period when his writing got weird, but he was literally suffering from a brain tumor at the time. But I still love those novels too. I won't go into detail, but if you want to know more about the argument, another of my favorite science fiction writers, Spider Robinson, wrote a speech for a science fiction convention that was published independently, and you can find it for free online, called Ra Ra Ra, being as that Robert Anson Heinlein's name was R-A-H. And he makes a better argument for why the author deserves respect than I possibly could. But Spider Robinson is another one who plays with fantasy and science fiction and very clever wordplay. He's also a musician and a poet, and his writing is fantastic. And he does a lot of stuff about the deeper sense of the universe and the surprises that unfold that make magic the same as science and vice versa.
Well, there's the famous Arthur C. Clarke quote that any technology that's so far advanced is indistinguishable from magic.
Yeah, sufficiently advanced.
Sufficiently advanced.
Yeah, it's wonderful, and it's true. If you look throughout human history, that's always been the case, mm-hmm. right? The ability to knock someone down from a distance.
Or yeah, exactly. Or how about you're on shores, and the biggest boat you've ever done is just a little canoe, and then off on the horizon you see these giant white things coming towards you. Yeah, never seen anything like it. And then it stops near your shore, and then, okay, no, I recognize that. That's a small, that's a boat. Oh, there's people. But then, later on, there's these four-legged beings that are towering over, running towards you, and they have two heads, and you've never seen it in your life. You have no idea what it is. Horses. When horses came to the Americas, no one had ever seen them in the Americas.
It's amazing, right?
Yeah, and to them, imagine that. Have never seen a horse or a human on a horse. Yeah. And then seeing that.
That's another really cool thing about looking at the history of science, mm-hmm. is you see where these overlaps happen, where new things are discovered, and they explain them according to the tropes of the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like, I think we may have talked before about the hippopotamus, mm-hmm. right? Hippopotamus, water horse or river horse,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Because the Europeans who brought the news of it back, I think it was to Rome, the Europeans who brought the news of it back.
How do you explain it?
To describe, yeah, it's a water four-legged horse. Creature with a long face, but it lives in the water.
Sea lion.
Yeah, sea lion, great example, right? We've got so many stories like that of creatures or even events where you try to make sense of it as best as you can. Hmm. And looking back on it, we can say, wow, that was a crazy idea. But it wasn't. It was really trying to use contextual knowledge to explain a new experience.
Absolutely, yes. There's a lovely account of probably an explosion, asteroid crashing into the moon that was documented in the 15 or 1600s by a monk. It's just looking at it.
Wow.
And paraphrasing so much and can't remember the specifics of it, but it documents quite specifically looking up at the moon and seeing a glow and then this like cloud coming out of it. And I think they even traced it back, figured out it's probably that crater.
That is so cool.
But funnily enough, this monk's description of it wasn't like trying to be anything holy. He's just describing it,
right?
Which is interesting, because a lot of people would jump to what does this mean.
Was he a Franciscan?
I don't know. I'm not even going to confidently say he didn't jump to conclusions. I can't remember. But there's a little piece of knowledge in the back of my head.
Because of the topic of science fiction, I could talk about science fiction mm-hmm. all day. I'm mm-hmm. a big fan of early science fiction, you know, like To the Moon, a science fiction novel written by Cyrano de Bergerac, right, in which people go to the moon by building a platform that will be lifted by the dew in the morning when it rises into the ether, right? Which was ether, lovely explanation of how dew works.
Yeah.
Right? It, with no understanding of the rain cycle or anything else, but it made sense at the time. And so you end up with this thing that has to be called science fiction because there was a scientific attempt at explaining what was going on.
Yeah, the ether is a fun concept.
Yeah. I mean, is it as science fiction as when Jules Verne said, well, you can voyage to the moon in a bullet, a giant bullet, right? Well, yeah, it was a different mechanism.
It's pretty much what we did.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm a huge fan of that, but there are a couple of other folks I have to mention mm-hmm. for science mm-hmm. fiction. Asimov.
Of course.
Isaac Asimov. If you haven't read Isaac Asimov, he says, looking into the camera and trying to look into the souls of people who aren't watching, if you haven't read Isaac Asimov, please do. You don't have to read all of Asimov because that will take several lifetimes. But read some. He was a brilliant writer with ridiculous ideas. He coined the term robotics when he was 19, right?
Yeah.
Literally defined the term. The first person to ever use it. And when he wrote it in the third page of one of his stories, he didn't know no one else used the word. He just assumed that was the term.
Makes sense.
Right? But Asimov, absolutely brilliant. But also,
I think, sticking on Asimov, it's Asimov that I could be mixing up with Arthur C. Clarke. I think it's Asimov. There's a short story about them building a supercomputer because they're trying to figure out the universe and answer to entropy, butchering it all. It's a short story. It's basically one, they develop it over time and over time and over time, and it gets smarter and smarter and smarter and better and better and better because it's trying to solve the problem of entropy. I think this is it specifically. It's trying to solve the problem of entropy, and it gets more and more intelligent and smarter and smarter and smarter. It starts out as just like a normal computer in modern day, but throughout time there's this continuation of it, and then they start giving it more and more energy. It starts assembling itself bigger and bigger. It starts using galaxies to do its compute power, and then it gets closer and closer to the edge of the universe, and it's like orbiting up the last black hole to get its energy, and then it finally figures out, and then the first thing it says is, "Let there be light."
That sounds like something Asimov would write, but others as well. I love Asimov science fiction. His robot stories are clever science fiction, but also with maybe his most famous series of robot stories, they're detective stories too. Mm-hmm. And he wrote great detective fiction, short fiction. He had two different published series. First one was for one magazine, and when they stopped publishing him, he recreated the series under a different name with different characters so he could publish it in another magazine. His first novel was, he was a professor of chemistry, and he wrote a novel called A Whiff of Death, in which a chemistry professor realizes that a colleague he hated and who hated him has been poisoned and has been killed with something that obviously links to it being the chemistry professor himself who did it, and he knows he didn't do it, and mm-hmm. he feels he's the only one smart enough to solve it. This Boston police detective on the scene is a bumbling fool who's going to butcher the case, so the chemistry professor is trying to figure out, how can I solve it in a way that will stop this idiot from thinking it was me? Well, the idiot is actually brilliant, pretending to be an idiot, and it is the exact character of Columbo from the TV movies. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the writers who created Columbo eventually admitted that, we just stole the character from Asimov's first novel.
Yeah,
it's more lovely writing. I mentioned Spider Robinson briefly. His novels are great if you like wordplay. He is a punster and has characters who are punsters in almost all of his novels. He does serious science fiction and really lighthearted science fiction with some serious themes. He's also a folk musician and a fantastic guitarist, singer-songwriter. Well worth checking out. He collaborated with his late wife, Jeannie, to create the field of zero-gravity ballet. She was a dance teacher. They have a novel called Star Dance that became a series of novels. you know, going into a very different idea of speculation, but what would dance be without gravity? Right? Like, it's just, there's so many great ideas out there being written by so many great writers. Steve Perry, not the musician, but a science fiction writer who wrote probably the best episode of Batman the Animated Series, a cartoon famous for having a lot of great episodes. He wrote Night of the Ninja. He also wrote some of the best Star Wars novels ever. He wrote a series of books based on the premise, if you experienced Relim Pago, if you experienced the touch of God, the moment of enlightenment.
Beatific vision.
Yeah, and realized, oh, the world is unjust. I have to change it. Would it be possible for one person to bring about the overthrow of a galactic empire? And he decided it would be. And he wrote a story in which it happens. It doesn't happen quickly, but it's not supposed to. Mm-hmm. Could you, with a message of peace, defeat a warlike oppressor? The novel series is called The Matadors. The last time I exchanged words with him on Facebook was back before I worked at Facebook, so it was years ago. But he was working on a new book in the series. I think there have been seven already. His publisher stopped publishing them a few years ago, unfortunately. His work is brilliant, very fast-paced, very deep thinking, and very cool speculations about a lot of things. If faster-than-light transmission of information is super expensive, it wouldn't be enough to communicate just with your voice or with written words. You would have to communicate in multiple modalities at once for it to be worthwhile. What would that be like? Mm-hmm. Could people learn to do that? So he's got a type of communication called fugue, where people are using two different series of hand gestures and other expressions along with speech and voice modulation. So lots of cool things like that.
Yeah.
But his idea, as a lifelong martial artist, his idea that you could, with pacifism, overthrow violence, but it would take a long time and some interesting changes of mind. I so recommend it. The first book is called The Man Who Never Missed. And if that's the only book in the series you read, it's well worth it. And if you look up The Man Who Never Missed, you can find Steve Perry. And if nothing else, buy an ebook copy from him, because he sells them directly now.
I was going to take a note, but then this podcast is a note. And actually it will be useful to, we'll link all of the books mentioned
in this podcast
at the bottom as part of this.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Yeah. We have to support these authors. Folks who rely on publishers are living in a tight space, right? When the publisher says, there's not enough market for your book anymore, what do you do? If you're lucky, you get the rights to the book back.
Yeah.
Or if you're Cory Doctorow, you never gave them the printed rights to the book in the first place, or at least the full rights to the book. Yeah, I think Cory Doctorow's model of science fiction publishing, or publishing in general, is the model of the future. You know, we share profits on what you print, but on what nobody prints, that's mine to give away or keep or do what I want with.
Yeah. Hopefully, people will always appreciate humans writing stories. Our previous podcast, we've been talking about AI text generation and such, and there's already people flooding bookstores. Well, I say bookstores, Amazon. People have been flooding Amazon with nonsense, which might be a good reason for publishers actually to come back seriously strong. Is to be the gatekeepers of, no, this is worthy of putting down into paper, into reality.
Yeah, exactly. But when people say AI has access to all of the wisdom of humanity, they're forgetting Sturgeon's law, right? 80% of everything is crap.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And Sturgeon, another great science fiction writer, well worth reading. Check out his short story, A Slow Sculpture, or any of the stories in his best of collection called Caviar, because what else would be the best of a Sturgeon? Yeah, Amazon is full of work that you can buy. I've got friends and relatives who have books on Amazon that were written with loving care and deep concern and lots of thought and lots of effort to make it as good as possible. But their books are selling right next to books that somebody wrote with an AI, or that somebody wrote without ever using spell check, or that somebody wrote in a direct ripoff of somebody else's book. It's a shame, but it's out there. I agree, we need to have... It used to be that if you wanted to read a book, you'd go to the library. And some people could afford to go to bookstores, but all of us could go to libraries if you lived where there was one or if you were visiting where there was one. And when you went there, there were these wise, wise people, almost always women, who could guide you towards things that would blow your mind.
Mm-hmm.
We need that for the internet.
Yeah. Pagemasters. Remember that film, yeah. Pagemaster?
Yeah.
I think it was Christopher Lloyd. Was the librarian in that.
I think you're
Pagemaster.
Right. Wow, yeah. There's a blast from the past. Next week, we'll talk about Pagemaster.
Yeah.
But yeah, we need librarians. Librarians are people who have dedicated their lives to understanding quality and organization and thoughtfully consider both things. Yeah, the modern rush towards AI, towards fast tech, towards a fail fast is a rush away from considered thought, and it's good, really good, to have people who specialize in it.
Absolutely, considered thought feeds rush to fail. There's scenarios where rush to fail is good. Software development, sure, if you've got no consequences and you're in very early phases where you don't have users.
There we are.
That's fine. Good.
Yeah.
Iteration, if you're writing your concepts of your ideas for your stories, yeah, sure, rush, iterate, play yeah. around with ideas. When you're developing machines that are supposed to go into orbit and use billions of taxpayer dollars, probably don't rush to fail. Probably be a bit more considered. I'm specifically talking now about SpaceX. The Apollo program, their first test, their first Apollo Saturn V rocket, was unmanned. It took off. It went to orbit. It did all its procedure and didn't fail. Now, there was an absolute fatal failure with Apollo 1. When astronauts were in it, there was a fire. But after that fire, they started even more rigorously and seriously, being very, very serious about, no, we do not rush to fail. We are serious, we do things properly, we communicate, and we make sure that never happens again.
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, the idea of speed as required for profit has overtaken most common sense in most industries now.
Yep.
Because of this notion that's really only become popular since the 80s, as far as I can tell, that the folks who are making a profit from everything we do need to make more profit next quarter than this quarter.
Mm.
And
mm-hmm.
that must always be the case. And that is not an algorithm that works in the real world. That's an algorithm for how algae grows. That's an algorithm for how cancer spreads. That's
smatter outbreak.
Yeah. Which I was wondering, is that short for transmatter? Because you were talking about how it's breaking down things in order to make them into something.
Maybe, new. I'm not sure.
Because that's an old idea, yeah. right? That if you started something that could take things apart and build yeah. new things out of it, how would you turn it off if it ate the off switch?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it just made me think of that. Anyway, yeah, careful consideration is a good idea.
Absolutely.
Caution is a good idea.
Proceed with caution.
I'm always astounded by people who say that they are conservative in their politics and then destroy things they cannot restore. If you're conservative, then you should be always working to avoid the dissolution of things you cannot restore, right? That you should be conserving them.
Yeah, institutions and forgetting why things were set up in the first place. I mean, it's human history. We forget. Any generation, you can say to a kid, don't do this, don't do that. But sometimes they have to learn for themselves. And unfortunately, it seems like it happens on a civilizational, generational level too.
Piaget talked about this in terms of learning stages of development in the brain. We go through an era of only believing we can think. We are the only ones who can. And gradually we come to accept that other things around us in the world can also think. And gradually we come to accept that they can think as well as we can, maybe even better.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows us to go from psychogenesis, the ability to learn from ourselves, to generate ideas ourselves, to sociogenesis, the ability to understand and accept and learn from the ideas of others. The difference between those is reflection. And the ability to think slowly and carefully as opposed to reacting quickly and emotionally. Somebody who you've already mentioned is Elon Musk. And I wonder sometimes if the fact that he brags about not sleeping much, the fact that he brags about sleeping under his desk or sleeping only a few hours in a day or a week, I wonder if that's done to him what it does to so many of us, and removed our ability to access the slow and considered and reflective part of our brain.
Well, I don't know if you've ever seen him talk. He takes long pauses, but what comes out of his mouth is never usually that smart.
I haven't watched him talk in a long time. I try to avoid it.
Yeah.
I also used to like Kanye West's music until he became a self-avowed Nazi.
Yeah, that's annoying when artists... It's like, stop it. I like your music. Stop. Yeah. Michael Jackson, just please.
Ender's Game was a great novel, but it had anti-Semitism built right into it. And everyone was like, yeah, but that's one of the characters, until his second and third and fourth books.
Yeah.
Shame. Orson Scott Card, great writer, cannot read his work now. Mm. And I don't mean no one else should read his work.
Well, that goes into a whole other debate. Can you separate the art from the artist?
Which would be a great debate.
Which is a whole other debate. Let's not go into it, because I think that is a whole other debate
to
explore.
Let's do that another week.
Take out the threads and figure that one out.
What do you guys think? Would you like us to talk about that? Is there something else you'd like us to talk about?
Yeah.
Let us know.
And I keep saying let us know or get in touch, and I never tell you how to get in touch. If you do want to get in touch at any point and have some ideas or criticisms or any feedback in general, email podcast@jamiesun.dance. That's podcast@jamiesun.dance. You can email that and I will hopefully remember to check it.
Nicely done.
But you can also find us on social media and such as well. If it's not hard to find me or John and get in touch.
Yes, it's really easy to find Jamie.
Yeah. So I'm gonna go back. I've got one more series to talk about before we finish up. And that is Remembrance of an Earth's Past, which is the book series that includes the Three-Body Problem.
Oh.
It's a trilogy. Have you read The Three-Body Problem?
I have not. No, it's one of those books I've been meaning.
It's fantastic. It's a point in time to talk about it because Netflix has just come out with a series for the first book, Three-Body Problem. It was all right. It wasn't too bad. I think the tone could have been better. I think the tone in the book moves you a bit more than the TV series, at least. But Chinese author.
Lu Zexin.
I want to say. Probably pronounced completely wrong. But there's a lot of good concepts in those books. And it was the first sci-fi that I'd read from China specifically, and just having a different flavor to everything was really interesting. Just different culturally mindset on things, but still sci-fi. It was an interesting to look at some tropes of sci-fi but have this other flavor to them. I really enjoyed it. It's hard to explain too much without going into major spoilers. Okay. But I can say with the first book, just the opening few chapters of the book hooks you immediately, because essentially theoretical physicists all around the world are killing themselves and they're going crazy. And essentially the reason they're going crazy is that physics is broken. Particle colliders, all the data is just going random. So like at the subatomic level, the universe is being completely random and nonsensical, and it's driving everyone crazy.
Oh man, okay, thank you. I will read that soon. Thank you.
And it's fun. There's a lot of philosophy in it as well, like foundational philosophy, like what is the philosophy if worlds are different? Because a lot of our philosophy is tied to the heavens. Like early thinkers, philosophers were the scientists throughout human history, and a lot of it's always tied to the sky and looking up and trying to make sense of the heavens. What happens if you're if your civilization grows up on a planet that's different? And there's a lot of good, interesting things around that. It's a bit clunky in places with some of the ways it goes about it, but overall it's just fantastic. The second book proposes something that's now kind of getting more colloquial in answer to the Fermi paradox, which is the Dark Forest Theory. I don't know if you know about the Dark Forest Theory. That's his second book, Dark Forest.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's an explanation for why we don't hear from other civilizations.
Right. Yeah.
And it's the idea that keep your mouth shut, because the second you show that you exist and you might be a problem later on, because if just take a few notions, if advanced civilizations can advance rapidly and exponentially, then the distances in time of planets away from each other, basically it's the second you know about them, they're X amount of light years away. That means in their rapid development, they will have the power to wipe you out. So it makes sense, act first, wipe them out first. So the second you hear from anyone, get rid of them.
Out. Yeah, the Fermi paradox is very cool, and it's one of those questions that people have been arguing about
for
a long time, and rightly so. It's precisely why some people said, do not send out space probes.
Yeah, Stephen Hawking famously as well put his name out there and said, maybe let's just be quiet, proceed with caution.
Yeah, sort of the opposite of, what is it, fail fast.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't mean to interrupt your discussion of that series. Just because you said it's interesting to read this Chinese perspective of science fiction, I have to ask if you've ever read Ishiguro.
No.
The Japanese science fiction writer.
No, no.
Read Clara and the Sun.
Okay. It's a fairly, I've heard of that, yeah, yeah.
Fairly new novel.
Yeah.
It's about AI. It's about robots. It's about how different will we be as a consumer society when you can bring a robot home. And it's told from the perspective of the robot.
Nice.
It is so beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a heartwarming story and heart-melting story.
I would say I have consumed a lot of Japanese media, probably less so books, more movies, films, anime, TV series and whatnot. But yeah, books less so. That's a tangent.
Yeah, well, we can spend some time on that in another podcast as well.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay.
You were about to discuss the third book. Second book is The Deep Forest.
Dark Forest. It's interesting how he considers how generations think. He calls, he has names for generations of people and periods of time, where the ways that people are thinking, like there's a pessimistic era, an optimistic era, and the defining these eras of humanity and their optimism and pessimism, how it affects everything. Super interesting and fun. The other main overarching theme that is in a lot of this is cosmophobia. Absolute fear and dread of the universe and the energy and darkness out there, which almost feels in line with Lovecraft.
Okay.
Absolute kind of Lovecraftian fear of the unknown, but this cosmic unknown. Which is the one we were talking about, ether. I remember specifically in one of Lovecraft's stories, there's these beings from another world. It's always kind of interdimensional, unexplainable, completely unexplainable. And there's these beings that are just outside this guy's house that are coming in and out, and they have wings, and their wings flap in the ether, and that's how they can just travel through space. But in this book series, Remembrance of the Earth's Paths, there's just so many big concepts that are absolutely terrifying. Like, we seem completely small bugs in the view of the cosmos and the energies out there, that really we're absolutely nothing, and it can be used against us in terrifying ways.
That's wonderful.
But overall, there is a lot of optimism in it too. Balances out these two.
Nice. Well, I think the balance is important. I worry when we get too scared, we become too violent.
Mm.
Spider Robinson, who I mentioned earlier, said anger is always fear in disguise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really good phrase to keep in mind. People are so angry these days, so quick to anger, including myself sometimes, which just surprises me. I'm not an angry person. And lately, I've been feeling anger in situations that would usually make me just laugh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a bad state to be in.
Yeah, and you can see it. People forget that it's not just a line of growth, things get better, positivity. Like, it's not a line that's just guaranteed.
Yeah.
It takes work and commitment and serious professionals at the top of everything to maintain things and understand where things can go wrong and not play so recklessly with our civilization, ultimately. People in power across the world absolutely just taking things for granted, forgetting why their grandfathers set things up in specific ways.
And forgetting that their grandfathers were trying to make things better than what had come before.
Yeah. And
maybe the right way to respect that is to go on trying to make things better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a strange state we're in right now, where misinformation and disinformation is so much more prevalent than it's ever been before.
It's much more easy and quicker to spread a lie than correct things.
Yeah, it truly is, which is another good reason to fact check and sort of promote.
Yeah, which is why we're trying our best to fact check on the fly and not misinform you with incorrect authors or titles or whatnot.
Or by leaving people out. We're not trying to misinform you by omission. I think that the two of us could sit here and probably I've got
20 other books I'd like to talk about, but I was actually going to be using this as the start. I was going to be talking about habitation specifically and technology of habitation. Mm. That's why I was going into the orbitals and whatnot. And then even when I was writing my notes, I was going off on a tangent, trying to keep it together to one theme. But
there's too much good science fiction out there. Have you ever heard of the Hominid series by Robert Sawyer?
Yes.
There's a parallel universe in which Neanderthals evolved to our current state. And a Neanderthal scientist and a human scientist start communicating across this void. And it's really compassionate. Mm-hmm. And it's really about learning to accept the alien. And it's just beautiful. It's so cleverly done.
That's where in the last podcast you were saying, and it's stuck with me, and the more I'm thinking about it, the more I want to tell stories, is that the stories where whoever is the enemy, you actually end up becoming friends and working together with. And I didn't say at the time, but when I thought about it after, it's like Ghibli films are always that. Spirited Away, you look at Spirited Away, you start off with that film, you're like, this is scary, everything is mean and antagonistic. And every single antagonist in that story ends up becoming not. It's just a friend.
Yeah, oh, the river monster?
Yeah, the river monster, the mask, no face.
The coal spreads.
Yeah, everything. Yeah. Just as scary initially. It's like it's a child's perspective. This is scary. I don't know what this is. Oh, wait, it's your uncle. It's your friend. It's
a weeding friend.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Studio Ghibli is so clever, specifically Miyazaki Hayao.
Yeah.
Just everything he's done is incredible.
Yeah, And that's a theme throughout a lot of his stories.
That terrifying transition to adulthood.
Yeah.
And
all right, I'm going to have to cut it. I've got a hard deadline now that I've passed 20 minutes ago.
Oh, okay. This has been great.
Absolutely. I would love every time. So if you have listened all the way through here, thank you again. Remember, you can get in touch with us by emailing podcast@jamiesun.dance. Let us know how you feel about the podcast, if you think we could improve in any ways, or you would like to be a guest or have any topic suggestions for us. Please do let us know, and we will see you next time.
Yeah, thanks everybody. Come on back.
Sock Talk is a production from the Robert Gordon University School of Computing.
Today's episode was brought to you by the letter pi and the number pi.